Today is July the 3rd, and tomorrow is the big celebration, the birth of our nation 243 years ago. What makes the USA different from other nations in the world? Constitutionally guaranteed free speech. The First Amendment to the Constitution says, Congress shall make no law respecting establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble, and to petition the government for redress of grievances. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, and Amazon are using your personal data? Is that product you bought from Amazon a counterfeit? You should find out. Our website is pcradioshow.org, and we can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet, as well as on various podcast hosting sites. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm on the Internet and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the number is 641-793-7091. And for those who are listening to the program on demand, you can leave us a message with your question or comments to hank@pcradioshow.org. You can also reach us on Google number 862-800-6805. Start your message with the Personal Computer Show, followed by your message. Google Maps have been infiltrated with fake businesses. There's a massive amount of information collected by Google, and it's near impossible for them to verify the accuracy of all the information. Google uses the collected data to enhance their applications to generate more ad revenue. Be on the alert that Google Maps have been infiltrated by millions of fake businesses. Google has been adding a lot of new features into Google Maps. These go beyond apps and navigation. Features like direct messaging to businesses, highlighting favorite dishes at restaurants, and hashtag reviews have all helped make Maps into an interactive business directory. It is now overlaid on accurate maps of wherever you are or will be at any given moment. This is a smart, clever move by Google, as it makes Maps able to take users away from apps like Instagram and WhatsApp Business app. Like all services, however, the success of this new direction for Maps will depend on trust. According to a new report by the Wall Street Journal, millions of fake businesses could be on Google Maps right now. According to a Wall Street Journal investigation, a new problem has spread across Google Maps. The report claims that false businesses are hijacking the locations and addresses of legitimate businesses on Google Maps. There could be up to 11 million false businesses operating on the app at any given moment. Google has been quick to respond to the report, releasing its own blog about how it deals with these types of scams. They are claiming that last year, Google Maps took down more than 3 million fake business profiles, with more than 90% of them removed before any users saw the profile. Most of these came from Google's internal systems, but 250,000 of them were reported by Maps users. Google so far has been unable to stop or scam businesses getting through its vetting process. This is about 250,000 of the number of fake businesses. The analysts from the Wall Street Journal found that this means there are still millions of fake business profiles active on Google Maps, despite all efforts by Google. How do you avoid fake businesses on Google Maps? With Google's best efforts falling short on this one, and fake businesses regularly breaking through onto Google Maps, this reminds us a lot of another Google marketplace, the Google Play Store. The Play Store has time and again been overrun with false apps loaded with malware developed by scammers. Look for local businesses that have other user reviews. Look for a web URL. Google the business and look for other sources of information other than the Google Maps listing. If something doesn't look or feel right, just look elsewhere. Key Biscayne joins Riviera Beach and Lake City, falling victim to ransomware attack. It's starting to look as if Florida cities have become the favorite target for ransomware attacks, after a third local government was struck by the malware within the last few weeks. Key Biscayne joins Riviera Beach and Lake City in having its systems infected by a form of ransomware after it identified a data security event early last week. In all three cases, the malware made its way onto local government computers when an employee clicked on an email link that allowed it to be uploaded. Hey, I said that before. Disconnect the email and external communication systems from the back-end network. If you continue to link them, all you're doing is opening up a liability. People should take heed that if your neighboring communities are being hit with ransomware, you may be next. Key Biscayne is working with outside counsel and third-party forensic experts to ensure that its systems are secure. They should have done that earlier. And to determine the scope of the event. Last month, it was reported that Riviera Beach had agreed to pay hackers $600,000 to restore its encrypted systems. A week later, Lake City's insurance provider negotiated a payment of 42 bitcoins, or around $500,000 at that time, to unlock its computers. In the latter case, $10,000 of the money came from taxpayers. But you can be sure now the rate will go up for future payments on insurance. Both Key Biscayne and Lake City were hit with Ryuk, the final piece of what is known as the triple threat attack, the other two being Emotate and TrickBot malware. It's uncertain whether the Riviera Beach attack was also based on Ryuk, which was originally linked to the notorious North Korean Lazarus hacking group. While paying hackers to unlock ransomware usually isn't advised, as there's no guarantee they'll hand over the decryption key. City officials agreed that this was the best, easiest, and cheapest, as the bulk is paid by insurance. The wealthy island town of Key Biscayne has just 3,000 residents, making it much smaller than Lake City with a population of 12,000 and Riviera Beach with a population of 35,000. A special council meeting to discuss the issue was held last week, where it was decided to spend $30,000 on hiring a data recovery firm, although it appears the city isn't ruling out paying the hackers. The village manager incurred additional expenses necessary to expeditiously and fully resolve the current data security event. Outside of Florida, it's also reported that Georgia's state court system was hit by ransomware, and Ryuk also appears to be the culprit, according to a source. This case is worrisome, in particular, because ransomware has also crippled the city of Atlanta's IT network last year, costing officials millions in recovery efforts, and also hit Georgia's Jackson County, where officials dished out a $400,000 ransom payment earlier this year. It appears that despite some pretty high-profile cases, Georgia officials don't appear to have learned anything from previous incidents. Does your PC seem to sputter along while you try to shut down the system? It could be the result of a newly unearthed bug that impacts how long it takes machines running a certain version of Windows 10 to shut down or enter sleep mode. Microsoft confirmed that the bug on the company's tech community page and notes that the delay can sometimes be as long as 60 seconds. Now, as far as bug goes, this one is a benign bug. In other words, it's not going to cause any problem or damage to your system. Still, if you're ready to leave your house and are patiently waiting for your computer to shut down or go to sleep, watching your computer just sit there for upwards of a minute can be, well, frustrating and unnerving. According to Microsoft, the bug specifically impacts Windows 10 version 1809 and comes into play if USB Type-C devices happen to be connected. I guess what they're saying is, if you want it done quickly, unplug all Type-C devices before shutting down. A bug in the USB Type-C connector system software interface implementation in Windows 10 version 1809 can cause a 60-second delay in the system's sleep or shutdown process If the power down happens while the UCSI software is busy handling a new connect or disconnect event on a USB Type-C port. It's worth noting that the bug doesn't cause any other system performance issues or impact the functionality of attached peripherals. The system and USB Type-C ports should continue to function properly after the next wake or restart of the system. As it stands now, there's no indication as to how long users will have to wait before Microsoft rolls out a fix. But it stands to reason that this particular issue isn't at the top of the company's to-do list. Just be patient. According to the Washington Post, more than 1,100 tracker cookies were found in Google Chrome. These tracker cookies were making profiles for companies and marketers to help advertise products to you. Interestingly enough, the writer discovered that all of them were blocked when he browsed with Firefox. The Washington Post article describes how Google tracks your data, and it goes into great detail how to clear out the tracker cookies. However, at the end of the lengthy article, the writer recommends that you best get familiar with a new browser. He should have started off with that instead of going through all that detail. As stated, more than 11,000 tracker cookies were found in Google Chrome, and instead of going through the exercise to undo the tracking, just switch to another browser. Clearing the tracking cookies will not guarantee that there will not be any more as you use the browser. Starting October 1st, 2020, the federal government will require those boarding domestic flights to carry a driver's license or other identification card that is Real ID compliant. However, the New York State Department of Motor Vehicle, that's DMV, offers residents two options, a standard Real ID or an enhanced ID. So what's the difference between the two? Both the Real ID and enhanced ID will allow travelers to board domestic flights and enter some federal buildings. However, enhanced IDs will also allow residents to cross U.S. land and sea borders from Canada, Mexico, and some Caribbean countries without the need for passport. Enhanced IDs do not authorize air travel between these countries. Strictly land and sea travel, passports are still required for all international flights. Real IDs are marked with a star logo in the top right corner, with enhanced ID featuring banner that reads Enhance, along with an American flag in the bottom right corner. Standard ID card, which are still valid for all other purposes outside of domestic flights and entering federal buildings, now feature the phrase not for federal use in the top right corner. Those who wish to obtain a Real ID must go to the DMV office. You cannot get a Real ID online, by phone, or through the mail. There is no additional cost to get a Real ID. However, all normal transaction fees still apply. An enhanced ID will cost an extra $30 in addition to the normal transaction fees. Valid U.S. passports are already Real ID compliant and can continue to be used to board flights. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his continuing IT Pro series. Tonight, he will cover root cause analysis.
Technology in the workplace is abundant. This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now I'm going to cover some of the relationship that we have with work technology and personal technology. They mix together a lot. These two items go hand in hand so well. And we don't always realize this. We don't always think about all of the different things that cross over. I'm dumbfounded at times where I see something and I go, oh, that's just like it is at work. Today, I want to talk about root cause analysis. And root cause analysis is a situation where we have to dig to the bottom of the issue. Let's start off. Let's label a couple of items. I'm going to talk about incidents. What is an incident? This is where your computer reboots in the middle of the day, or maybe in the middle of the night. It doesn't matter when it reboots. We just know that it reboots on a regular basis. Now, if it just reboots once, that's an incident. But if it keeps rebooting, and it keeps rebooting every day at 9 p.m., that can actually develop into a problem. A problem is a multitude of incidents. It's a combination of a number of different factors that just keep repeating over and over and over and over again. And they create, yes, not an incident, not something that's incidental. I hope that helps there. But it creates a problem. This is a problem, not incidental. It's a problem. Okay, so we put these items together. Now we have to dig deeper. We have to find out what is the root cause of all of these incidents. What is the root cause of the problem? Yeah, you see what I'm saying? We get to the bottom of the problem, which is the computer rebooting every day. Now, we go back. This goes back to, very early, big, huge, computers the size of a room days. And there was an incident like that, where every night, sometime around 9 or 10 o'clock at night, the entire big, huge system would shut down, and then it would come back online. Now, you would think that's just an incident. Nobody's actually using it, but you kind of want to drill down. You kind of want to find out what's going on there, because that could develop. Because we also know that incidents that develop into problems can become bigger problems. Why can it be a bigger problem? Because after a certain amount of time, we are going to lose data. We're going to go through some kinds of issues where, yes, the system is just not reliable. Now, if we know it's rebooting every night at 9 or 10 o'clock at night, that's an indication of unreliable computing, which is also a scary situation. Now, in this case, in this particular story, this guy would go on in, the janitor, he would go in and he would unplug the system because he needed to plug in his vacuum cleaner. And we laugh about this. We think, this is just a matter of, it's a simple guy. He's just a janitor. Well, janitors can be some smart guys, too. He just didn't know that he was creating any issues for anybody else. He just knew that he needed a vacuum and he needed to keep the place clean. So we have to look at these. Marty Winston was talking with me recently. He had a particular series of incidents going on. His system was rebooting, and it was actually far more frequently than every night at 9 or 10 o'clock at night. It actually started rebooting a matter of every 10, 15, 20 minutes. It was rebooting. Now, that can be very annoying. You're sitting there. You're trying to surf the internet. You're trying to do research. You're trying to type a letter. You're trying to check your email, whatever it is, and all of a sudden your system just reboots. Now, that's an idea of a problem. It's a number of incidents developing into problems. So he had to dive deep into the system. He started looking at all kinds of different issues in regards to his hardware. And this actually came up to a very interesting situation. And when he told me about this, I was taken aback because I'd never heard of anybody having this particular problem. Over the course of time, and this is kind of a side note for you, over the course of time, we work with the CPUs. We put the CPUs on the motherboards, and then we put a heat sink on top of that. But in between the heat sink and the CPU, the brain, the Intel chip, your AMD chip, we put something called thermal paste. And what that does is it makes it more efficient for all of the heat to go off of the CPU over to the heat sink. Think of radiator fluid, and you're putting enough radiator fluid to make sure that your car stays cool. It's transferring the heat from the engine over to the radiator through the fluid. Again, the thermal paste is kind of your radiator fluid. Now, in this case, what we found out was that there was too much thermal paste between the CPU and the heat sink. And what happened there was it actually started to leak out from between the two. So there you go. There's your root cause, or most of the root cause. It was actually leaking out, and it was stretching on out, and it was causing a short circuit on the motherboard itself. And there's your root cause. That's why it was rebooting. Again, we just have to make sure we find out what those problems are. And sometimes, yes, the problem may be once a week, but we start tracking those. And I want to encourage you, sit down, do what an IT guy would do. Do what every IT professional should be doing. Create yourself some kind of log, some kind of diary, we'll call it, and keep track of every single computer problem you have. Eventually, you might have the data of all of those incidents to get to the root cause of the problem. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. One of the biggest names in technology, and he also happens to be an iconic figure, has said that big tech must be regulated now. At the Economic Club of Washington held last week, Bill Gates thinks government needs to regulate big tech now. Is Amazon a monopoly? Google and Facebook are great at selling ads. It's terrible for journalism. Is Google a monopoly? Bill Gates says the U.S. government must step up its regulation of big tech companies whose influence in culture, business, and all areas of life is becoming more pervasive. Gates said technology has become so central that government has to think, what does that mean about elections? What does that mean about bullying? What does it mean about wiretapping authorities that let you find out what's going on financially or drug money laundering? Things like that. His thoughts on government interference in the tech sector were particularly relevant given recent government scrutiny of the size, influence, and privacy practices of tech companies such as Facebook, Amazon, Apple, and Google by both antitrust enforcement agencies and political candidates. Gates said he expects that there will be more regulations of the tech sector, particularly as it relates to privacy issues. The protection of user privacy and use of user data has been a flashpoint, especially for Facebook, which has been criticized for multiple data scandals. The fact that now this is the way people consume media has really brought it to a realm where we need to shape it so that benefits need to outweigh the negatives, he said. Microsoft faced its own antitrust lawsuit in 1998 and was forced to change some of its business practices as a result of its settlement with the U.S. Justice Department. Gates said that today's tech giants have been able to learn from his past mistakes. He said, I, for the early years of Microsoft, bragged to people I didn't have an office in Washington, D.C., and eventually I came to regret that statement because it was kind of almost like taunting Washington, D.C., Gates said. Now, the other tech companies are very engaged. And it appears his own company learned, too. Microsoft, so far, has avoided the antitrust examinations its fellow big tech companies are currently facing. Bill Gates has properly raised the alarm, but he did not offer any proposal to regulate big tech. Antitrust has been determined by the economic impact on the consumer public. We need to expand this to more than just economic impact. The self-proclaimed management of cultural news by big tech with use of smart algorithms cloaked in terms of artificial intelligence and machine learning masks the fact that these technologies are developed and implemented by people with built-in personal viewpoints. It just gives the appearance that the machine-generated decisions are unfettered by any bias. This is so far from the truth. There are growing concerns that Facebook's bans are going too far. Some are calling for the end of the safe harbor that allows the companies to moderate content, while others are calling for more active regulation of big tech. Currently, under Section 230 of the 1990s Communication Decency Act, Facebook and other online platforms are not liable for the content posted by their users. Before Section 230, Internet service providers faced what is known as the moderator's dilemma. Courts had found that the early Internet service provider, CompuServe, was not liable for the content posted on its bulletin boards because it did not moderate the content. However, CompuServe's competitor, Prodigy, wanted to maintain family-friendly boards, and to do it, it moderated the content. Courts found that this meant Prodigy was liable for content posted by its users and could be sued alongside a given user posting libelous content. The dilemma was whether to accept the possibility of unmoderated content turning a company's board into a cesspool that can damage its brand, or to accept possibly ruinous liability by trying to stop it. Crucially, the law doesn't just protect big tech, it protects the users too. Any organization with a website that allows user comments or interactions is also protected by Section 230. This helped the growth of online communities. The moderator's dilemmas were solved. The law allows moderation without liability. Site owners are free to decide what kind of content to allow their users to post. That's why most sites develop a form of community standards. Sites could and do ban users. Rules are necessary in online communities to ensure bad speech does not drive out the good. Social media platforms have their own versions of community standards, breach of which can lead to one being blocked from using the site. The platform's critics claim that those rules and their enforcement amount to, therefore, should be liable for their content, as the court decided in the Prodigy case. Yet Congress passed Section 230 precisely to allow moderation. The internet has expanded the number of platforms that users have, and this is complicated by the many different languages involved. Genuine editorial oversight is virtually impossible given current technology. Moreover, attempts to use technology to proactively enforce community standards have not been successful. Attempts to use algorithms to define decency have repeatedly flagged material deemed by many to be legitimate content. If government regulators were to look over the shoulders of moderators, political opinions would once again become the preserve of the newspapers and opinion journals, and millions of political voices would be silenced overnight. The alternative is to enable all speech and accept that unwanted speech by some is the price for the freedom of speech. There is precedent for such an action. When the Supreme Court ruled to allow American flag burning, on June 21, 1989, which is just 30 years ago, a deeply divided United States Supreme Court upheld the rights of protesters to burn the American flag in a landmark First Amendment decision. What is Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act? Section 230 of the Communication Decency Act of 1996, a common name for Title V of the Telecommunications Act, is a piece of internet legislation. It provides immunity from liability for providers and users of an interactive computer service who publish information provided by others. An immunity clause in the Act states that no provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. In analyzing the availability of the immunity offered by this provision, courts generally apply a three-pronged test. A defendant must satisfy each of the three prongs to be immune from the liability. First, a defendant must be a provider or user of an interactive computer service. Second, the cause of action asserted by the plaintiff must view the defendant as a publisher or speaker of the harmful information at issue. Third, the information must be provided by another information content provider. That is, the defendant must not be the information content provider of the harmful information at issue. The Communication Decency Act was passed to enhance service providers' ability to delete or otherwise monitor content without them becoming publishers. It was Congress' intention in enacting Section 230's broad immunity to internet providers because when faced with potential liability for each message republished by their services, interactive computer service providers might choose to severely restrict the number and type of messages posted. The court held that Congress considered the weight of the speech interest implicated and chose to immunize service providers to provide any such restrictive effect. The dividing line in determining whether an entity is an internet service provider or an internet content provider hinges on editorial publisher function and when something is a statement being made by information content provider. Section 230 of the Communication Decency Act provide broad protection to internet providers. However, if a provider edits the content that materially alters its meaning of a statement and the new statement is defamatory, then the immunity is waived by the provider. Second, if the website creates or develops illegal activity, then the immunity is waived. Third, failing to comply with promises to remove material may waive liability. You might also lose the protection of Section 230 if you promise to remove content and then you fail to do so. The main defense is that the website was a provider of the information. If the website was merely a passive provider, then there is no liability for the defendant to a civil action. Net-net, after all is said and done, Section 230 says that no provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as a publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. In other words, online intermediaries that host or republish speech are protected against a range of laws that might be otherwise be used to hold them legally responsible for what others say and do. The protected intermediaries include not only regular ISPs, but also a range of interactive computer service providers, including basically any online service that publishes third-party content. Though there are important exceptions for certain criminal and intellectual property-based claims, the Communications Decency Act 230 creates a broad protection that has allowed innovation and free speech online to flourish. It offers its legal shield to bloggers who act as intermediaries by hosting comments on their blogs. Under the law, bloggers are not liable for comments left by readers. The work of guest bloggers, tips sent via email, or information received through RSS feeds. This legal protection can still hold even if a blogger is aware of the objectionable content or makes editorial judgments. So, everyone seems to acknowledge that there is a problem with big tech. We've heard from some of the other tech leaders, but they don't offer any specific solution that is workable. With Section 230, tech companies get a sweetheart deal that no other industry enjoys. Complete exemption from traditional publisher liability in exchange for providing a forum free of political censorship. Instead of being good corporate citizens, big tech companies such as Facebook and Google has not been transparent about their content moderation practices. A Google senior executive recently said that Google has repeatedly been clear that it works to be a trustworthy source of information without regard to political viewpoint. In fact, Google has no notion of political ideology in its ranking. This was said by Jen Janai, head of responsible innovation at Google. However, a whistleblower leaked internal emails to Project Veritas that appears to contradict Jen Janai's claim that Google has no notions of political ideology in the search rankings. Senator Hawley from Missouri, he's a Republican, introduced legislation to amend Section 230, immunity for big tech companies. What he proposes is a major update to the way big tech companies are treated under Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. Senator Hawley legislation removes the immunity big tech companies receive under Section 230 unless they submit to an external audit that proves by clear and convincing evidence that their algorithms and content removal practices are politically neutral. Senator Hawley's legislation does not apply to small and medium-sized companies. The proposed legislation simply states that if the tech giants want to keep their government-granted immunity, they must bring transparency and accountability to their editorial processes and prove that they don't discriminate. In defining what is politically neutral, it is subjective and is to be determined by the FTC. This creates even more ambiguity to what is acceptable and not acceptable. This proposed legislation just adds another layer of oversight that is at best subjective, and it only creates new challenges for big tech to redefine how they will get around any restrictions. What would be a wake-up call for big tech? One would be break up the company in which they end up competing against each other, such as what they did to AT&T. The other is simply repeal the immunity waiver. However, these two methods are subject to congressional legislation, and in effect, it will be tied up by lobbyists, politicians, and special interest groups. I have a better idea. Why not just have the FTC invoke suspension of trading of the stock on the exchanges for 30 days each time a violation is confirmed? Congress then doesn't have to take any heat. Just a thought. It will work. The shareholders will go after them. Presenting Marty Winston with his project to finish a bunker basement 30 feet by 50 feet.
For years, I was explaining my design for an energy miserly 40-year maintenance-free cybernetic house. And we bought a lot in Aiken, South Carolina as a build site. Then several things happened. I'll tell you about two of them in a second. Several things happened and compelled me to change directions. One of those things was some missing math, a forgotten factor. The design costs that I had outlined, the design costs more up front than a standard build, but it does cost less over time. Except, and this is the missing math piece, investing the extra upfront cost of my design at even a low interest rate would make up the difference of the long-term cost advantage and make the whole thing a wash. Well, I was being disheartened by that. Several pals were egging me into the direction I'm taking now. Hey, Marty, whatever number of people might follow your plans to build that kind of home from scratch, there are zillions more who aren't about to move from the house they're in now but would absolutely love to cut their energy bills. And they were absolutely right. So were those who said, you know, not everybody lives in a place where it's warm all the time and you've been focusing on dealing with heat a lot more than with cold. They were right, too. I had hoped that moving out of the blizzard belt might let me melt my snow shovels, but now, well, soon enough, I'll need new ones. We sold our property in Aiken and moved back to Geauga County, Ohio, in the Maple Sugar Hills just east of Cleveland. Our brilliant real estate agent, he really is, Bill Butler, found us a two-story house on 1.5 wooded acres built in 1979, so it's 40 years old, and it was still occupied by the original owner. We closed in late April. My new approach is about retrofitting existing houses to cut their energy bills, maybe yours, to 40% of what they are at the starting point now, while also at the same time increasing comfort, increasing convenience, increasing safety. So a lot of the same principles of the original house design, but reapplied. I'm shooting now for a new radio and TV series called Marty's on the House, a phrase that I hope every bartender I meet will pick up. Marty's on the House will be 1-minute weekly segments on one-at-a-time little projects to help people get to that savings point. Those segments will start airing in September on stations across the country and here. And one major utility company will also post my segments on their websites. That's the umbrella picture. By the way, there will be TV as well. That's the umbrella picture of what I'm doing now. But what I want to talk about today is the only unfinished area in the house, the basement. Cinder block walls, a roughly 7-foot ceiling and roughly 30 feet by 50 feet. It's a big space. It has a lot of the usual basement stuff. A breaker box, a sump pump, a hot water tank heater, a heat pump, a utility sink, lots of fluorescent fixtures and so on. I'd hate to tell you how few electrical outlets. So the first step was to find a carpenter, Dave Petrie at Distinctive Woodworks, and start framing the walls and designing our spaces. Let's see if I can draw you a picture in words. Think of it as 50 feet being wide and 30 feet deep, so landscape mode, okay? The first step was to frame the outer walls while putting a 3-mil plastic vapor barrier between the 2x4s and the cinder block. The basement's dry. It's been dry, but you never know. We added a new wall across about 2/3 of the center. Well, as you look at it, think of it as halfway up and then 2/3 from left to right. About 15 feet to the top, about 15 feet to the bottom walls in that landscape mode. The bottom half of the space, which is closest to the front of the house, is fairly well divided by a central stairway to the main floor, so we added a wall next to that. The back of the stairs and the back of that new long wall, which is, that area is the top of your mental image toward the back of the house, that's where the environmental systems make their noises and where our racks will go. And we framed to enclose that middle back noisy space. That left a top corner for a test lab. And we put a freestanding wall between where our Seobrigs test bench will go and where the sump wells are in the floor. They'll get a big hinged cover. All the way on the right, back to front, we put 4-foot-deep storage shelving on the back of the house, the upper part of what your mental picture should be. And we put 2 closets on the lower front of the house side, also, flush front, same 4-foot depth. We'll make the one closet that's closest to the shelves a cedar closet. The one down in the lower corner had an old 24-position circuit breaker box. It's where the radon remedial system got installed. Did I mention that we found radon? And it's where the cable service enters the house. So that's where we had them put their distribution amplifier, which, of course, we plugged into a UPS. All the way to the far left wall, and still on the front of the house, bottom part of your mental image, well, that's where I set up my office, but really, it's more than that. So let's start with the part that really is the office. Now, my office space needs are more complicated than most. I have a fairly high horsepower desktop PC and 2 monitors. I bought a new L-shaped table-style desk and mounted a pair of 43-inch Vizio 4K TVs as my monitors. My Pro Audio-Technica condenser mic is on a low-rise OC white arm that's also clamped to that same new desk. The desk is tucked into a middle corner where that new wall meets the framing on the cinder block wall all the way to the left. Behind me, a rectangular table-style desk acts as kind of a credenza. It has a pair of short roll-about 2-drawer files underneath, and a printer on a rolling stand off its free end. Beyond that, the other side of the credenza from my desk, is my Sanus rolling enclosed mini rack, which houses my cable modem, the router, the switch, the UPS, the UMA interface, the TiVo bolt, phone connections, and a few odds and ends. Beyond that, there's a door to a second stairway. This one goes up to the 2-car garage. Very handy when you're moving a lot of lumber down. That's maybe 1/3 of the total space. The rest of the space that's in my office carve-out is really my TV Studio A. That means the desk can be one of the shooting sets, and the rest of the space can let me set up many other shooting sets. There's also a small Studio B adjacent to the test lab area, right on the other side of that wall. Beyond the framing and the signal network wiring, there's been already a lot of electrical work. Now, I'm swearing off outlet multipliers and power strips and deliberately reducing the loading on electrical runs, so we tore out the old 24-position breaker box and installed a new 60-position box. We added whole house surge protection. We're wiring the basement for power where we need it, meaning roughly 150 new outlets. We have to box wire the ceiling for the points where we plan installing LED fixtures. Put them on switches. The equipment rack locations need a 20-amp outlet. The steam humidifier needs a 240-volt feed. Electrical is a lot easier when the framing is up but the walls are not yet in, which is where we are now, about half done with that wiring. We'll add 2 kinds of insulation in those walls and parts of the rafters: thermal insulation and acoustic insulation, which means that any frame sections that don't have something firm on at least one side need to have that added. So we're going to use a specialized, I'll get into this later, another segment, we'll use a specialized sound deadening gypsum board for one side of each of those walls. And yeah, there's a lot more to tell you about that, but we'll talk about acoustics on its own. We'll want to hang 2x2 suspended ceiling frames from up top as close as we can to the bottom of the rafters so we don't lose too much height. Remember, we're only starting with about 7 feet, but we have more work to do in the ceiling before that happens. The metal tube ductwork costs a lot of energy through losses and lets too much noise through, so I need to pull those down and replace them with double wall insulated flexible round ductwork. I'm going to have more to tell you about ducts next time. The metal water pipes also lose a lot of their hot and cold along their runs, so those get replaced with PEX pipe, plus Armacell Turbolit insulation around the PEX pipes. Water will stay hotter through most of its run and over time in a way that most of us are never going to encounter with what comes with our houses. So that's most of what's on deck right here, right now. We still need the plumber to install a mana block for the PEX piping and to do those PEX runs and to install our Noritz tankless water heater, plus a new utility sink. We need the HVAC guys to replace the indoor elements as we prepare for an amazing outdoor HVAC subsystem and to install the April Air whole house air cleaner, the steam humidifier, and indoor air quality monitoring and control system. And once the old hot water tank goes, we need a masonry crew to come in and remove the old chimney stack that it's using. That stack is a remnant of the original oil furnace that's, well, that's long gone. There's more still to be done here, of course, and some of it has to do with changes we have to make in the house's two attics. And then there's flooring. But those are stories for another time. Next time, I'll be looking at the tin tubes. They're really steel, but I like the alliteration of tin tubes. Okay, the metal tubes that are supposed to be improving our comfort in the house, but that often make things less comfortable in some parts of the house, more costly for the house as a whole, and, in a creepy way, put duct right into the middle of counterproductive.
Thank you, Marty. A picture's worth 1,000 words. I hope you had first developed project expense first. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. All these computer club meetings are open, free to the public. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets on Friday, July 5th. They meet at 8 p.m. and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, located at 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Kings Bite Computer Club meets Tuesday, July 9th. They meet at 7 p.m. and they gather at the Park Plaza Restaurant at 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn, New York. Computer Learning Center at Ewing has a presentation on Apple Seeds and Apple Devices Thursday, July 11th, and they meet at 2 p.m. in the afternoon, and their location is 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on recycling e-waste and pioneering urban sustainability, Thursday, July 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at NYU 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, room 414, and that's in Manhattan, New York. The Westchester PC Users Group has a presentation on web design, Thursday, July 11th, and the presentation is at 7 p.m., and this was originally rescheduled from the first week of July 4th, obviously it's a national holiday, so they moved it to the following week. They meet at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road on the first floor in White Plains, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group meet Friday, July 12th. at 7 p.m., and they meet at the New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, and it's located at Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, and they meet in the auditorium of the Harry J. Scherr Hall. Princeton PC Users Group meet Tuesday, July the 23rd, and they meet at 7 p.m., and it's at the Mercer County Library, located at Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Brookdale Computer Users Group has a meeting on Thursday, July the 25th. Starting time is 6:45 p.m., and there will be a presentation on Hard Disk Sentinel, which is a monitoring and analysis software, and iCloud integrating Apple and non-Apple devices. They meet at the Middletown Library Large Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. The Danbury Area Computer Society has no meeting scheduled for the summer until September the 3rd, but they normally meet at the Danbury Hackerspace at 158 Main Street in Danbury, Connecticut. We hope to see you at one of these meetings. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the Internet. Podcasts are available from all major podcasting host sites, as well as our website, pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us or commentary on any of our feature segments, just send us your email address with your telephone number, in which we can call you at a convenient hour for playback on the program. If you have any questions for us, just send us your email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week. This nation will remain the land of the free, only so long as it is the home of the brave. Freedom is not free, and that the freedoms we enjoy every day should not be taken for granted.